Chapter 3 Not a Nice Party. Chevette never stole things, or anyway, not from other people, and definitely not when she was pulling tags. Except this one bad Monday when she took this total asshole's sunglasses, but that was because she just didn't like him. How it was, she was standing up there by this ninth-floor window, just looking out at the bridge, past the gray shells of the big stores, when he'd come up behind her. She'd almost managed to make out Skinner's room, there, high up in the old cables, when the tip of a finger found her bare back, under Skinner's jacket, under her T-shirt, touching her. She wore that jacket everywhere, like some kind of armor. She knew that Nanopour was the only thing to wear riding this time of year, but she wore Skinner's old horsehide anyway, with her bar-coded Allied badges on the lapels, the little ball chains on the zippers swinging as she spun to knock that finger aside. Bloodshot eyes, a face that looked as though it were about to melt. He had a short little greenish cigar in his mouth, but it wasn't lit. He took it out, swirled its wet end in a small glass of clear liquor, then took a long suck on it, grinning at her around it, like he knew she didn't belong here, not at a party like this, and not in any old but seriously expensive hotel up over Geary. But it had been the last tag of the day, a package for a lawyer, with Tenderloin's trash fires burning so close by and around them. Huddled, all those terminally luckless, utterly and chemically lost, faces aglow in the fairy illumination of the tiny glass pipes, eyes cancelled in that terrible and fleeting satisfaction, shivers that gave her, always. Locking and arming her bike in the hollow sound of the Morrissey's underground lot, she'd taken a service elevator to the lobby, where the security grunts tried to brace her for the package, but there was no way. She wouldn't deliver to anyone at all except this one very specific Mr. Garreau in 808, as stated right here on the tag. They ran a scanner across the barcode on her Allied badge, x-rayed the package, put her through a metal detector, and waved her into an elevator lined with pink mirrors and trimmed in bank vault bronze. So up she'd gone, to 8, to a corridor quiet as the floor of some forest in a dream. She found Mr. Garreau there, his shirt sleeves white and his tie the color of freshly poured lead. He signed the tab without making eye contact. Package in hand, he'd closed the door's three brass digits in her face. She'd checked her hair in the mirror-polished italic zero. Her tail was sticking up okay and back, but she wasn't sure they'd got the front right. The spikes were still too long, wispy, sort of. She headed back down the hall, the hardware jingling on Skinner's jacket, her new SWAT trainers sinking into freshly vacuumed pile the color of rain-wet terracotta. But when the elevator doors opened, this Japanese girl fell out, or near enough, Chevette grabbing her beneath both arms and propping her against the edge of the door.
"Where party?"
"What folks gonna ask you?" Chevette said.
"Floor 9, big party."
The girl's eyes were all pupil, her bangs glossy as plastic. So Chevette, with a real glass wine glass full of real French wine in one hand and the smallest sandwich she'd ever seen in the other, came to find herself wondering how long she still had before the hotel's computer noticed she hadn't yet left the premises. Not that they were likely to come looking for her here, because someone had obviously put down good money to have this kind of party. Some really private kind, because she could see these people in a darkened bathroom, smoking ice through a blown glass dolphin, its smooth curves illuminated by the fluttering bluish tongue of an industrial-strength lighter. Not just one room, either, but lots of them, all connected up. And lots of people, too, the men mostly gotten up in those suits with the four-button jackets, stiff shirts with those choker collars, and no tie but a little jeweled stud. The women wore clothes Chevette had only seen in magazines. Rich people, had to be, and foreign, too, though maybe rich was foreign enough. She'd managed to get the Japanese girl horizontal on a long green couch where she was snoring now, and safe enough unless somebody sat on her. Looking around, Chevette had seen that she wasn't the only underdressed local to have somehow scammed entry. The guy in the bathroom working the big yellow Bic, for starters, but he was an extreme case. Then there were a couple of pretty obvious tenderloin working girls, too, but maybe that was no more than the accepted amount of local color for whatever this was supposed to be. But then this asshole's right in her face, grinning his mean-ass drunken grin, and she's got her hand on a little folding knife, something else she's borrowed from Skinner. It has a hole in the blade that you can press the tip of your thumb into and snap it open, one-handed. That blade's under 3 inches, broad as a soup spoon, wickedly serrated and ceramic. Skinner says it's a fractal knife, its actual edge more than twice as long as the blade itself.
"You're not enjoying yourself, I think," he says.
European, but she's not sure which flavor. Not French or German. His jacket's leather, too, but nothing like Skinner's. Some thin-skinned animal whose hide drapes like heavy silk, the color of tobacco. She thinks of the smell of the yellow-spined magazines up in Skinner's room, some so old the pictures are only shades of gray, the way the city looks sometimes from the bridge.
"Doing fine till you showed up,"
Chevette says, thinking it's probably time to go. This guy's bad news.
"Tell me,"
he says, looking appraisingly at the jacket and the T-shirt and the bike pants,
"what services you offer?"
"The fuck's that supposed to mean?"
"Clearly," he says, pointing at the tenderloin girls across the room, "you offer something more interesting."
And he rolls his tongue wetly around the word, "than these two."
"Fuck that," Chevette says. "I'm a messenger."
And a funny pause crosses his face, like something's gotten past his drunk, nudged him. Then he throws back his head and laughs like it's the biggest joke in the world. She gets a look at a lot of very white, very expensive-looking teeth. Rich people never have any metal in their teeth, Skinner's told her.
"I say something funny?"
The asshole wipes his eyes.
"But we have something in common, you and I.
I doubt it."
"I am a messenger," he says.
Though he looks to Chevette like a moderate hill would put him in line for a pig valve.
"A courier,"
he says, like he's reminding himself.
"So, Prajan,"
she says, and steps around him. But just then the lights go out, the music starts, and it's the intro to Chrome Karan's She God's Girlfriend. Chevette, who has kind of a major thing for Chrome Karan and cranks them on her bike whenever she needs a boost to Prajan, just moves with it now, everybody dancing, even the icers from the bathroom. With the asshole gone, or anyway forgotten, she notices how much better these people look dancing. She finds herself opposite this girl in a leather skirt, little black boots with jingling silver spurs. Chevette grins. The girl grins back.
"You from the city?"
the girl asks as She God's Girlfriend ends, and for a second Chevette thinks she's being asked if she's a municipal messenger. The girl, woman, is older than she'd thought, late 20s maybe, but definitely older than Chevette. Good-looking without looking like it came out of a kit. Dark eyes, dark hair, cut short.
"San Francisco?"
Chevette nods. The next tune's older than she is. That black guy who turned white, and then his face fell in, she guesses. She looks down for her drink, but they all look alike. Her Japanese doll dances past, bangs swinging, no recognition in her eyes as she sees Chevette.
"Cody can usually find all he needs in San Francisco,"
the woman says, a tiredness behind her voice, but at the same time you can tell she thinks it's all pretty funny. "German," Chevette thinks by her accent.
"Who?"
The woman raises her eyebrows.
"Our host."
But she's still got her wide, easy grin. "Just sort of walked in."
"Could I only say the same?"
the woman laughs.
"Why?"
"Then I could walk out again."
"You don't like it?"
Up close, she smells expensive. Chevette's suddenly worried about how she must smell herself after a day on the bike and no shower, but the woman takes her elbow and leads her aside.
"You don't know Cody?"
"No." Chevette sees the drunk, the asshole, through the doorway into the next room where the lights are still on. He's looking right at her.
"And I think maybe I should leave now, okay?"
"You don't have to. Please, I only envy you the option."
"You German?"
"Padanian,"
Chevette knows that's part of what used to be Italy. The northern part, she thinks.
Who's this Cody?
Cody likes a party.
Cody likes this party. This party's been going on for several years now. When it isn't here, it's in London, Prague, Macau.
A boy is moving through the crowd with a tray of drinks. He doesn't look to Chevette like he works for the hotel. His stiff white shirt's not so stiff anymore. It's open all the way, wrinkled tails hanging loose. And she sees he has one of those things like a little steel barbell through one nipple. His stiff collar's popped off at the front and sticks up behind his neck like a slipped halo. The woman takes a glass of white wine when he offers the tray. Chevette shakes her head. There's a white saucer on the tray with pills and what looks like twists of dancer. The boy winks at Chevette and moves on.
You find this strange?
The woman drinks her wine off and tosses the empty glass over her shoulder. Chevette hears it break.
Huh? Cody's party.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I just walked in.
Where do you live?
The bridge. Watching for the reaction. The grin widens.
Really? It looks so mysterious. I'd like to go there, but there are no tours, and they say it's dangerous.
It's not, Chevette says, then hesitates. Just don't dress up so much, right? But it's not dangerous, not even as much as the neighborhood around here. Thinking of the ones around the trash fires. Just don't go out on Treasure Island. Don't try to go all the way to Oakland. Stay over on the suspension side.
You like it, living there?
Shit, yes. I wouldn't live anywhere else.
The woman smiles. You're very lucky, then, I think.
Well, Chevette says, feeling clumsy, I gotta go. My name is Maria.
Chevette, offering her hand. Almost like her own other name, Chevette Marie.
They shake.
Goodbye, Chevette.
You have a nice party, okay?
This is not a nice party.
Settling the wide shoulders of Skinner's jacket, Chevette nods to the woman, Maria, and begins to work her way through the crowd, which is tighter now by several degrees, like maybe this Cody's friends are still arriving. More Japanese here now, she notices, all of them serious suits. Their wives or secretaries or whatever are all wearing pearls. But evidently this doesn't prevent them getting into the spirit of the thing. It's gotten noisier, too, as people have gotten more whacked. There's that loud, constant burr of party noise you get when the drinks kick in, and now she wants to be out of there all that much faster. She finds herself stuck near the door to the bathroom where she'd seen the icers, but it's closed now. A bunch of French people are talking French and laughing and waving their hands around, but Chevette can hear somebody vomiting in there. Coming through, she says to a man with a bow tie and a gray crew cut, and just pushes past him, spilling part of his drink. He says something after her in French. She feels really claustro now, like she does up in offices sometimes when a receptionist makes her wait to pick something up, and she sees the office people walking back and forth and wonders whether it all means anything or if they're just walking back and forth. Or maybe the wine's gotten to her a little because drinking isn't something she does much, and now she doesn't like the taste of it in the back of her throat. And suddenly there's her drunk. Her euro with his unlit cigar, sweaty brow too close to the dull-eyed, vaguely worried face of one of the Tenderloin girls. He's got her backed into a corner, and everyone's jammed so tight, this close to the door and the corridor and freedom, that Chevette finds herself pressed up against his back for a second. Not that that interrupts whatever infinitely dreary shit he's laying down for the girl. No, though he does jam his elbow hard back into Chevette's ribs to get himself more space. And Chevette, glancing down, sees something sticking out of a pocket in the tobacco-colored leather. Then it's in her hand, down the front of her bike pants. She's out the door, and the asshole hasn't even noticed. In the sudden quiet of the corridor, party sounds receding as she heads for the elevator. She wants to run. She wants to laugh, too, but now she's starting to feel scared. Walk. Past the party's build-up of trays, dirty glasses, plates. Remembering the security grunts in the lobby, the thing stuck down her pants. Down a corridor that opens off this one, she sees the doors of a service elevator spread wide now and welcoming. A Central Asian kid with a paint-splattered steel cart stacked up with flat rectangles that are television screens. He gives her a careful look as she edges in beside him. His face is all cheekbones, bright hooded eyes, his hair shaved up high in one of those near-vertical dos all these guys favor. He has a security badge clipped to the front of his clean gray work shirt and a Virtufax slung around his neck on a red nylon cord. Basement, Chevette says. His fax buzzes. He raises it, pushes the button, peers into the eyepiece. The thing in her bike pants starts to feel huge. Then he drops the fax back to his chest, blinks at her, and pushes a button marked B6. The doors rumble shut, and Chevette closes her eyes. She leans back against the big quilted pads hung on the walls and wishes she were up in Skinner's room, listening to the cables creak. The floor there's a layer of 2x4s laid on edge. The very top of the hump of the cable, riding its steel saddle, sticks up through the middle, and Skinner says there are 17,464 strands of wire in that cable. Each one is about as thick as a pencil. You can press your ear against it and hear the whole bridge sing when the wind's just right. The elevator stops at 4 for no reason at all. Nobody there when the door opens. Chevette wants to press B6 again, but she makes herself wait for the kid with the fax to do it. He does. And B6 is not the garage she so thoroughly wants now, but this maze of 100-year-old concrete tunnels, floored in cracked asphalt tile, with big old pipes slung in iron brackets along the ceiling. She slips out while he's fiddling with one of the wheels on his cart. A century's worth of padlocked walk-in freezers, 50 vacuum cleaners charging themselves at a row of numbered stations, rolls of broadlooms stacked like logs. More people in work clothes, some in kitchen whites, but she's trying for tag-pulling attitude and looks, she hopes, like she's making a delivery. She finds a narrow stairway and climbs. The air is hot and dead. Motion sensors click the lights for her at the start of each flight. She feels the whole weight of this old building pressing down on her. But her bike is there, on B2, behind a column of nicked concrete. "Back off," it says when she's 5 feet away, not loud like a car, but sounds like it means it. Under its coat of spray-on imitation rust and an artful bandaging of silver duct tape, the geometry of the paper-cord carbon-wrapped frame makes Chevette's thighs tremble. She slips her left hand through the recognition loop behind the seat. There's a little double zick as the particle brakes let go. Then she's up and on it. It's never felt better as she pumps up the oil-stained ramp and out of there.